Let me do it.
You're listening to Around Comics, episode 195. Is Around Comics, the comic culture podcast, where each week our revolving panel of guests talk about everything in and around the world of comic books and comics culture. And Around Comics is recorded at Dark Tower Comics and Collectibles, located at 4835 Northwestern Avenue in Chicago. If you're in the area, please drop by.
You're so quiet.
Me?
Yeah, you seem like you're quiet.
I'm just gearing up, man. Right. I've had a day off of work. I took a nice long...
Cashew's leaning back in a chair like, oh, you're already doing it wrong.
I leave for a month and come back and get this.
No, no. No, not at all.
Well, hey, folks, I'm
Chris. I just thought maybe you're trying something out. That's all. I just
It's
a new way.
I'm Christopher Niesman, and alongside me on the round table, first of all, the prodigal son returns. Mr. Brian Salazar.
Can't stay away.
Hold on. I got to turn your mic down.
Am I loud? Am I
all
loud?
The way down.
No.
Visiting
that's right.
us, visiting us from Ontario, Canada, is a listener of the show, and it took us up on the drop by the shop and say hello, Mr. Scott Hearn.
Hi.
Wow, that's
come meet us challenge.
Pull that mic. Push that. Help him out with that mic.
That's a long way out of the way.
There you go.
That's a long drive to come.
It is.
Just for this specifically?
Seriously.
Are you kidding? You're not even going to like go see the Sears Tower or anything?
Dinner.
They've sat in a dark hotel room until it was.
But this was the catalyst.
Basically, we did that actually, Tom. We sat in the hotel room until we came.
I feel great about not going outside now.
It's very. It's nice slow boat ride.
The boat tours?
Yeah,
my wife wants to.
I do one every. I go every weekend.
I can't swim.
Wow!
He has to stay sharp.
Yeah, stay sharp on my architecture.
Yeah, he has to know where the escape routes are.
I'd like to correct the.
This is a meteor.
Yeah, I'd like to correct the tour guide.
Oops,
you're new here, aren't you?
You're new, yeah.
Next is probably the most disgruntled Brewers fan in the world. I'm sorry, Tom.
No, there's more. I guarantee.
Oh, okay.
More disgruntled than I.
Just don't tell them it's my fault because they haven't won since I went to Miller Park.
If they lose to the Braves, I might have to do something to you.
Are you
not because I want to, but because I have to do my part for the team.
More upset about the Brewers being swept by the Cubs or Brett Favre's refusal to just go away?
Neither one of them really truly upset. I mean, if this was the end of August or early September and the Brewers were now 5 back... I mean, it was obviously disappointing. I'm not going to pretend that it wasn't, but it's long. There's time to make up.
Yeah,
so it was disappointing, but it's not like the end of
4 games time. Is not a season.
And Brett Favre, I hope he starts his own league. I hope he brings back the XFL.
With $20 million, awesome. He'd be
He's
able
gonna
to.
He's going
to
bring back the XFL. No more fair catches. No more of that pussy way out on a punt.
I heard the high school team that he's practicing with in Mississippi there is getting upset because their quarterback can't get any reps.
You know,
with
here's
the first
thing.
Team.
Okay, I know we do a comic book show, but I think it's really funny this
is
idea
that for
that,
real?
Like, yeah, Brett Favre's been practicing with like a high school team, and I love this idea that no one's like maybe he won't be ready when he shows up because I remember high school football practice
out.
And it wasn't that hard. You know, like,
no.
Well, anyway, on to comic books.
Yeah, sorry.
Speaking of comic books, our last guest, a familiar voice on the show, he's a DC exclusive artist, Mr. Mike Norton.
Hi.
Hi.
I know you're not a fan of the exclusives. I was listening to
you. He doesn't think you should get paid.
What are you trying to take food out of my mouth?
No,
just
that's
some insurance.
No, what did I say?
Mike Norton would rather not die of tuberculosis, all right? Yeah. He'd like to have some medicine.
Would you like him to die old and poor?
No, what did I say? What was my disclaimer? Is that
I completely understood what you were saying. I was just like,
exclusives are good for creators, therefore I support them, but I don't think it makes sense.
Thank God you support them. That's all. Yes. Otherwise... Wow, we don't know what's going to happen.
Paul Levitz breathed a sigh of relief, and he was like, "Woo! Thank goodness."
All right, go back to work, everyone.
He dialed six of Mike Norton's digits on his phone. He was about to drop Norton until you said, I
can't handle this. You're gone. We let you go.
Well,
Waiting Place 3.
Before we get into some more comics talk here, I need to remind everyone that this episode of Around Comics is sponsored by InStockTrades.com. We're waiting for the trade.
Where'd the bell come from?
It's the Burnham Bell.
I didn't know that. It was real.
But at InStockTrades.com, waiting for the trade has never been easier. At InStockTrades, you can get trade paperbacks, deluxe hardcovers, showcases, essentials, omnibus editions, absolute editions, and more, all at great discounted prices. And right now, InStockTrades.com is carrying our Book of the Month Club selection, which is Charles
Tarot Byrne. Volume 1.
No, that's next month. Charles Byrne's Black Hole, and they have both the trade paperback and the deluxe hardcover. I don't even know if it's the deluxe hardcover. It's just the hardcover. I believe that's like $16.22. So you've got a couple more weeks.
Maybe you'd know for sure if you had the show notes.
Well, man,
where are the show notes? I'm disappointed.
Where are the show notes?
Free rolling, man. Hey, man, we did the road trip episode. No show notes.
Nothing. No, nothing. You're unchained. Unhinged.
You've been wanting us to do this.
I'm not complaining. I'm wondering.
I keep it all in my head.
Nothing is scripted anymore. Nothing is scripted. The team of writers is gone. The overhead is dropped.
Nobody is signed to an exclusive.
No. So I support them.
Yes.
Although I don't think it's bad. I just don't think it's bad. It's bad, but...
I support it.
I don't really support comic creators eating either. I don't think they should ever
eat. Starving artists make better artists.
I think if you're not drawing 4 books a month...
You need to pick up the slack a little bit.
So anyway, check out InStockTrades.com. Pick up Black Hole. You still have a couple more weeks before we record that episode and talk about that. So, all right, comic books. We like them. We talk about them.
Yeah.
You know, I think we're gonna ditch the whole top of the stack thing.
What?
What? Yeah.
Why? Really? I had something.
I'm very disappointed.
But you know what, Tom? You can talk about that, but it doesn't have to be, quote unquote, a top of the stack. And we're just kind of gonna go where the conversation.
This is my top of the stack.
book have you enjoyed this week? That's not your top of the stack, but you've really enjoyed it. It's your favorite book that you've read this week.
My favorite book this week that I want to talk about so badly is
recommend to people.
Black Panther number 39 by Jason Aaron. Of Skelt fame.
Hefe.
There's a T in there.
Yeah. Jeff Day. Helps out, Mike. You know all these people.
Paolo? I don't know. I've never heard of this guy.
Mr. Paolo, I'm sorry if I'm mispronouncing it. Hefe Paolo and Lee Loridge is the colorist. It's the Secret Invasion tie-in. The basic storyline is the Skrulls are invading Wakanda and Black Panther is defending it. If you haven't liked the Secret Invasion main story because you don't like
Trolls.
Tons of detail about stuff that's already happened, and you don't want to be filled in on
you mean
things
if
that
you don't want to read the same story over and over again.
This was really awesome because he starts off the story from the viewpoint of the Skrull leader of the invasion of the ships, and he's kind of like a Danny Glover in Weapon.
Yeah, this could be good or bad.
The Skrull is complaining because I'm 1 week to retirement and they got to invade Earth. Great.
He wants to move away someplace, but he's just got to finish this invasion. I know, and it sounds ridiculous, but it's actually really cool.
Is he the one who's got the decapitated head on the front?
But the thing is, that's like the viewpoint is this guy. Because it's half and half Black Panther story, and this guy's story that he just wants to finish it up and leave.
All right, guys, let's get started. I got some fishing to do.
And if I did have a criticism, it would be that in order to get the story to where it is, there's a ton of conceits that have to be made. But then I would also say the whole idea of Secret Invasion is based upon a lot of conceits. So I'm willing to stretch it for a good story.
Suspension of disbelief.
So in Black Panther, the Wakandans come up with a weapon that destroys all of the Skrulls' guns. But it also destroys all of their guns.
Oh.
So all they have are primitive weapons. They crash the Skrulls' ship like by hacking into it somehow, and the Skrulls do the same thing back to them. So we're in this situation where it's the Skrulls versus the Wakandans, and they don't have technology. It's like a hand-to-hand.
World War One bayonets.
Yeah, it's like it's like fighting with swords and knives, and you have these fight scenes of and one of the best parts is, you know, the Skrulls are approaching the Wakandan headquarters, and they're like, oh, there's Black Panther. But then out of the castle comes everyone else dressed exactly like Black Panther. So no, they don't know
I
which
am Spartacus.
One. Yeah, they don't know which. Yeah, I mean, this story is very reminiscent of Lethal Weapon, 300 in parts visually.
Spartacus.
You know, there's a lot of cliches in it, but I thought it was a lot of fun, and I thought I wish kind of Secret Invasion was more like this, more fun. Because it's not a high concept idea. You know, it's like, oh, well, let's really just have aliens fighting superheroes and, you know, let's not try and get too, you know,
too serious about it. They're taking a big action movie and they're trying to make it serious.
Yeah, it ended up being really fun. It reminded me a little bit of how Captain Britain is. Captain Britain's got the same thing where it's like this big action adventure story with like
touch
sort
of
melodrama. Yeah, it very much reminds me very much of the feel of that book. It doesn't have the same feel as the Secret Invasion main books. I mean, it's very much like the action now of them fighting, and I really enjoyed it.
Now, speaking of that, the Captain Britain MI-13, I finally went back and am reading the Wisdom miniseries. Mm-hmm. That was really good.
Mm-hmm.
I'm enjoying that. I'm only about halfway through, but
I liked the first issue.
Though. Yeah, it's good stuff.
I was like,
a bit confusing initially to me, at least. It was.
What's
up,
Paul Cornell?
Paul Cornell.
And I think that was his.
Some of the language was just hard.
I think that was his first comics work, and I think he even I'd heard an interview when he admitted that it kind of took him going through that miniseries to kind of.
But I liked it nonetheless. Yeah. It was a book that I remember reading the first couple issues and then going, yeah, I'm going to wait for the trade on it just so I can kind of get the whole thing in one chunk.
That's was a Max book.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
is Pete? Does anyone know? Is Pete Wisdom is he a longtime character? Is he a new character?
He's been around in Excalibur since the 90s.
Yeah, he's been around.
Oh, God, he's
reminded me a lot of like
15 years anyway.
Sort of a John Constantine-ish.
Yeah, he's obviously being played up like that. Yeah. But I looked at some of those new Excalibur issues, and he's just a straight up mutant, right?
Yeah.
And he's just got like some goofy mutant power. I forget what it is.
Well, in the MI-13, they've.
Is he not the one that was hooked up with Kitty? Or no?
Yeah. Well, they alluded to that. Yeah.
In the MI-13, they pretty much play him the same way from the. Not quite as much as from the Wisdom. Because in the Wisdom one, he's very irreverent and funny. And
Constantine-ish.
Very Constantine-ish.
Yeah, he's kind of like, you know, Constantine / James Bond with mutant powers.
Yeah, and they kind of play him the same way in the MI-13 book.
Mm-hmm. Which, same writer, so it makes sense.
Oh, was it?
Okay. Yeah, Paul Cornell is right. Yeah, he's writing MI-13.
The art in that is phenomenal.
Yeah. Is that Leonard Kirk?
Yeah.
God, is he good.
Just to finish up before we get too far.
I'm sorry.
No, it's good, because if you enjoyed the MI-13 books, you probably would enjoy the three-part Panther story. I don't know if it'll be any good after that.
Has Jason Aaron? I'm checking. Has Jason Aaron written anything that is bad yet? Is he still bad?
He wrote me
a
letter once that his
poor grammar.
Yeah, he misspelled.
I didn't love that Wolverine story.
Everything else he wrote is like
the Mystique one.
Yeah.
Instant Messenger.
I don't know what it is. You can't understand half of it.
Yeah, that's probably the
on emoticon.
I'd say that's probably the most. I'm not even. But it's still. Better than a lot of other Wolverine stories out there.
Which was the Wolverine?
The Mystique, the Hunting Mystique.
Oh, yeah. Didn't go crazy. I liked parts of it. I didn't understand. I still didn't, and we even asked him. I didn't understand the last fight where all of a sudden Mystique's just naked. I'm gearing up for a big battle against a vicious
gotta
mutant.
Get naked.
I'm getting naked.
And he
should have freaking killed her, man. He didn't kill her.
He didn't kill her.
He should have killed her.
Yeah, that was...
It would have been awesome if he had killed her and left it.
I'm sure Marvel wouldn't let him kill her off.
They would have brought her back.
They would have to make an event out of that for the death of Mystique. But Mr. Norton, you got anything you've been keeping up with?
Let's talk about your Gravity Hero Clicks.
Mark gave me a Gravity Hero Clicks.
How cool is that? When you and McKeever made up Gravity, were these the powers that you assumed he would
actually
have?
Actually, I was just noticing that because that's one of the things.
Let's see what he's got.
He's got, no, they're very much like, because when we did the book, we wanted his powers to be sort of nebulous, even to himself, because he's new. He doesn't really know what he can do.
Yeah.
Later on, like McDuffie and them and beyond and stuff kind of played around with that. Like he was using gravity fields to grab stuff and things like that. They kind of limited it on that. So he's pretty much got what he had in the original miniseries, which
he's got,
I kind of like.
Charge, super strength. Yeah. He's got toughness, which they call graviton field.
Pretty much
grit,
all
grit.
He. The salt. Gravity's only. He can control gravity, but in the R series was that he really only had the ability to affect it
locally.
Like he could fly, he could make himself appear super strong, but he's just making everything else light. So it was all on him, but
so explain why he can have incapacitate with a range of 8 if he has a 0 range, but he also has telekinesis.
Well, no, he doesn't have telekinesis.
Well, some of the cosmic.
When that character, he will not use the telekinesis.
Well, I think what I've seen of him now, like the McDuffie stuff, he's shooting stuff out and things like that.
Oh, that's the TK. That's how they.
I don't know how that would work.
That's a tight figure, by the way.
Are you going to go around to HeroClix tournaments and tell people before they use gravity?
Yeah.
If you want to be true to the character,
he doesn't use the telekinesis.
Don't use the telekinesis.
I
love it. I think that this is the first time this has ever happened that I've actually had a toy or something like that. But
made of something.
If I were to critique it, I would have made this gray cloud some kind of see through blue because. That's what we made his gravity field.
Whatever happened to those waiting place hero clicks?
By the way, for people
the only powerful one was Scott, and nobody wanted the rest of them. So.
For people that don't know, you and Sean McKeever co-created Gravity.
Yeah, from Marvel.
So
you,
anyone
you
out there?
Created.
No, it was mostly Sean's idea. I'm not going to come in and lie about that.
It's like the Kirby Stan Lee, mostly.
90%.
No, seriously. It was the other way around. It wasn't like, he's like, I got an idea, and then I come back and actually do all the work and get it done. No, it wasn't like that at all.
Why don't you make a character?
Yeah, it was exactly like that.
I want to draw something.
No, if it were Sean, it would be, why don't you make a character? But he's from Wisconsin, because all of his characters have to come from Wisconsin.
Well, I appreciate that, being from Wisconsin.
Do you know where Gravity's from?
What city is he from?
That's what I'm saying. Do you know what city he's from? No.
Kenosha?
Nope.
Manitowoc?
Nope.
Oconomowoc, Madison.
No.
Milwaukee.
Geneva.
He just grew up in the Mars.
Mike, I'm from Wisconsin. We're using up a lot.
He's from Sheboygan.
Did he go to Sheboygan North or South for high school?
Oh, I do not know.
Wow. Call McKeever.
We haven't done the flashbacks.
Text message McKeever.
It's all about the continuity for Tom.
Did he ever go to the Mars Cheese Castle?
Sure he had to.
Who hasn't?
Yeah. Well, Scott, what do you have for us?
You know what I really liked this week was the second issue of Haunt of Horror. H.P. Lovecraft and Corbin had done it.
Vince was really high on that.
Yeah, that was a really good book. Really good book.
Now, Corbin, he's also doing that the Hellboy, the Crooked Man miniseries.
He
is. And what else? And he's doing Conan, the Sumerian.
He draws 4 books a month. No, I'm kidding. I don't.
He has a ton of stuff coming out right now.
I didn't know he was doing
bare minimum.
Yeah, he's doing like a flashback section in the Conan book, which Tom you would pick that up.
Yeah, it was really good.
Yeah.
I don't usually read Conan. That was the first Conan book I ever read.
and it was pretty much exactly what I thought a Conan book would be, but it was good.
Now, how do you like the Lovecraft stuff whenever they... Because it seems like there's a comic adaption for Lovecraft or Lovecraft-inspired stories that comes out. It seems like a couple times a year.
Yeah, especially Boom. Cthulhu stuff, right?
Like Boom's got the whole Cthulhu... Yeah,
everybody and their mother's done those comics.
Is that stuff all open... Public
domain. Yeah.
It's got everybody.
We should do a Cthulhu cast.
Oh, there is one.
What? You know, really?
Pseudopod.
Really?
Is there really?
Yeah. Pseudopod.
What?
Pseudopod.
They've got to run out of stuff to talk about.
I understood what you're saying.
I think they do like...
It's called Pseudopod.
God damn it, Tom.
idiots.
I think they do like original like fan fiction on it or something. It's like audio...
Wow.
I'm not positive about that.
I don't know. It could be good.
But I believe that's true. I believe it is.
That was my favorite Christmas card last year, was one that Boom sent out.
Oh, yeah, the Cthulhu.
You got a Christmas card from Boom?
Sal did.
I got it.
Oh, well, yeah. You're the
we did.
Yeah. Well, it was two around.
It was two Sal and friends.
Yes. What did it say? It was Cthappy...
Cthappy
Cthulhu.
I saw Cthulhu kissing Mom by the Christmas tree.
Eating Mom
by the Christmas tree. so tell us about this book. Why did you like it so darn much?
Well, the adaptation's really good. Like, they have inside of it, it's got the poems and the stories, right? And like, he can take like a 15 line poem that really, when you read it, it's just like makes no bloody sense whatsoever, and make it into a story where you're like, man, this is really cool. And you read it, and then afterwards it's got the, you know, it's got the text, and you're like, good God, that has nothing to do with what I just read, but it was cool anyways, you know.
Well, I think that's one of the reasons why that stuff is so prolific still is that, you know, a lot of it was sort of ambiguous. And
did Lovecraft ever do any limericks?
Yes, but they drive you insane once you speak.
Oh, it's a man from Lazy.
They're not real funny.
Limerick will make you crazy.
But I mean, I think you just like interpret the stuff in whatever way you want.
You had actually done some Lovecraft research like a year and a half ago. For people that are out there,
the dark sciences.
Yes, I was. I was studying. I was trying to raise a demon, and I figured that was the logical place to start.
What's frightening is that you probably know, because Sal approaches everything with a very research attitude. I mean, you are constantly in research mode. It is frightening. It's like he'll see something on TV that interests him. It could be on.
Was it those couple weeks when you were wearing that cloak to the recordings constantly?
Yeah, that was it. No. Well, yeah, I have a weird obsessive compulsive disorder with. I get interested in something. I need to know every. I want to know. Like everything I can possibly know about.
Have you ever sacrificed a cat, though?
Well, it was already dead, but I...
Sacrifice is a strong word. Were you near a cat when it died?
With a knife?
Yes.
I got into some Cthulhu for a while and reading a lot of it.
But Cthulhu Night School.
Got into some Cthulhu. I was into it.
Yeah, I was into Cthulhu Night School.
It's a bad crowd, dude.
Well, Chris makes it sound like I was, you know, locked in a room and pouring over volumes for...
I figured it out!
Yeah, I figured out... Oh, no, you know what you're talking about is that I did that... I wrote that weird essay.
Oh, yeah.
Linking mm-hmm. Cthulhu to something. I don't even remember what it was. It was weird.
Kubla Khan.
Wait a minute.
Yeah, the Kubla Khan.
Wait, why?
I was bored.
Because he does this.
Something clicked in
what
my
was
head.
It that's amazing to me.
Yeah.
You know, that could be considered sort of insane.
Well,
I want to know what it was linked to. What is it linked to?
I don't even remember it.
Really,
I have to go look it up.
I remember you talking. I think you remember talking about Kubla Khan.
Yeah,
that wasn't that long ago.
Yeah, that was
it wasn't that long.
That was actually from a Jason Aaron line out of, was it Scalp?
Yeah, it was a Jason Aaron line in Scalp. That kicked it all off, and then I did spend like a week researching Kubla Khan, and then that went into Cthulhu somehow, and... It was a weird...
I'm fascinated.
Well, it's the internet. I mean, the internet is perfect
for
that
kind of
thing.
Well, I've just never been inspired by something so much that I had to go write an essay about it for no reason, because it's just like, unless somebody was going to read it... I'm not calling you... I guess I am, but... I'm more saying... I'm more saying admirable of it than I am.
The writing of the essay was more
pitying you,
more an exercise just to write.
Mm-hmm.
Call upon
the dark powers.
And call upon the dark powers.
That's amazing.
No, it was more.
I know you've been like this because I remember when. You guys were on a Cranecast and you busted out the sword knowledge, and I was like, what? That comes from more than a couple of conventions. This guy's.
I get interested in things and I get very.
No, I admire it because you are a research
fanatic.
Official
Cranecast man at arms.
He gets interested about something, he needs to know everything about it. I admire it.
Well, I do. I have a weird obsession that I want to know. I think it's because I don't want to regurgitate other people's opinions. I want my own opinion, but I can't, faithfully give an opinion on something unless I feel I know enough about something.
I wish more comprehensive. Like that,
you know, do you ever have the problem of trying to know the unknowable?
No, I don't get to it. I want concrete information.
We're going to get him on the anti-life equation one of these days.
Yeah. You and Kirby.
Yeah. Would you pass back the book that I'm letting you borrow?
I would like to talk
about it a little bit. I'm not Indian giving. I'll give it back.
Whoa.
I was...
Indian giving.
You will get it back. I just need it for some reference.
That might not be... I'm reinforcing that I said. I don't know if that's politically correct. Native American giving, Chris.
Oh. All of a sudden, I'm the unpolitically correct guy on the show.
Southern Illinois.
was lucky enough this past week that Eddie Campbell did a signing at Quimby's here in Chicago. Yes, and I stalked him. Very nice guy. After he beat me with a stick.
In a straight line, he can move, but you get him going side to side, he's got bad knees.
I'm sorry, continue, Chris.
So I had a chance to meet Eddie Campbell this week at a signing, and he has a new book called The Amazing Remarkable Monsieur Lyotard, and I've been reading this the last few days, just finished it up today, and absolutely loved it. I don't know if anyone here is a Eddie Campbell fan.
I love
but
Eddie Campbell.
His stuff is very different than what you're going to see in any sort of mainstream comics. It's his style is almost like a stream of consciousness is kind of the feeling that you get with it. If you've read Fate of the Artist, that's probably a good comparison, but maybe Black Diamond Detective Agency. It's kind of like in between those. There's some kind of wild, crazy concepts in here.
What's it about, kind sir?
It is about...
45 pages.
It's about Cthulhu.
It is about following the life of a trapeze artist in a circus who... His uncle was the amazing, remarkable Monsieur Lyotard, who is a real life figure in history. Was this amazingly popular trapeze artist? Actually, the song flies to the air with the greatest of ease. That song, I believe, was written about this guy, but he died when he was like 26 or 28, really young. And this book is about his nephew, who he left everything to, which was a blank book and a fake mustache. And
quite the inheritance.
God, Jesus.
And
he worked at the circus. What'd you think he was gonna give him?
and
he thought the a book leotard. Was filled with, he didn't know how to read.
and the final blessing that he gave him were the words, "May nothing occur." And so as the story progresses...
Sounds erotic.
Did he... one quick question. Mm-hmm. Did he die on the trapeze?
No, he died...
on the floor.
No one dies on the trapeze.
It's not the fall that'll kill you. It's the sudden impact.
Yeah.
No, I think...
It all looks soft, but it wasn't.
I think he died of a disease. Like a... tuberculosis or something like that. You would have researched this, but I did not.
Well, he already knows. He's just testing.
Yeah,
but the two things that are really interesting about the book are A, this was taken, and Eddie Campbell couldn't remember exactly who had said it, but he said it may have been Eisner, said that all great superheroes have their origins in the circus. And he said, well, me being the person I am, wanted to question that. And I was like, oh, no, that can't be true, and started thinking about it about the Fantastic Four. And if you look at them, like Mr. Fantastic, there's like the India Rubber Man, and the Thing is the Strong Man, and the Human Torch is the Flame Eater, and Invisible Woman Invisible Woman is the woman who disappears in the Magic Act. Okay, so he's like, okay, yeah, I guess you can find bases for superheroes in there. And there's actually, he takes all those characters.
What about Asriel?
I don't. I did tell him it finally made Takitani make sense to me.
Oh yeah.
But he actually has a little circus group in there called the Quartet Fantastique, and they're the Fantastic Four and all this takes place in like the 1890s. But yeah, it just kind of follows his life, and they do this whole Forrest Gump thing where these, you know, great historic events in like the late 1890s and early 1900s that they couldn't have done with the original Monsieur Leotard because he died too young, and so they invented
this
nephew.
Where does it take place?
In Europe.
So this is European Forrest Gump.
Yes. Like one of the last things is they take a voyage on the Titanic to come to America.
So the moral of the story is that a borderline retard can become successful in America. Their heart's in the right place.
And life is like a fake mustache.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, he doesn't make it if he came over on the Titanic.
No, I'm sorry.
He gave away the ending of the book.
He thinks about Europe. Europe sucks.
Well, they actually had to come over to save their friend, the midget clown, who had been accused of stealing the Mona Lisa. And then sentenced to prison in Devil's Island. So it's
still,
we're being very un-PC now.
It is a really, really fun read, and
I also said retard.
And Eddie Campbell's art.
I don't
like
using that word.
Yeah.
I don't know why I said it.
Yes. Darn you, Tom.
I know. Sorry. I apologize.
But Eddie Campbell's art in it is absolutely breathtaking. It's well off the mainstream. It's something that you don't want to breeze through. I'm going to go back and probably read it at least one or two more times because there's a lot of little things that you can pull out of
Thinking of the whole circus thing with superheroes, it's funny because once you start mentioning it, I started thinking about superheroes, and you have The Flash, and The Flash would put on exhibitions for kids of speed powers, where he would do stuff like throw stones in the air and fly by running up the stones before they hit the ground, which is sort of like a circusy thing.
Sure.
I would challenge it a little bit, only from a bit of a different idea. I think Houdini had a huge part to do with influencing a lot of the superhero creation. I mean, he was such an influential character. And I think his amazing, you know, showmanship and some of those almost superhuman abilities that he seemed to possess.
Sure, but
he could jump an eighth of a mile.
I think a lot. It's not that all far off. They
the
all
circus,
kind of related.
Yeah, it's not
sort
the,
of
yeah,
their
yeah.
Oh, escape artists and traveling circuses and
strong men,
the mutants, the freaks. You know,
do you remember that Uncanny X-Men episode where Mesmero had mesmerized the X-Men and they were all in the circus and stuff? That was cool. That was very cool. Good issue.
It's perfect. I'm looking forward to hearing what Tom has to think of. And there's a talking bear.
Oh yeah. I mean, it's going to be good.
I think I personally am a big fan of Eddie Campbell's, but I would say that I think he may be an acquired taste a little bit.
Oh, sure.
I would define him as that.
Absolutely.
Not everybody is going to fall in love with this. I think I told you earlier this week when you were talking about this book, I think he's an artist nowadays that is purely making stuff for himself. And I don't say that in a bad way at all. I just mean he's just doing what he really... This is what he's doing because he wants to do it, and not because he's trying to sell something or he's trying to make a living.
This is his art.
Yeah, this is exactly what he wants to do, and I love it myself because it's you're not going to get it anywhere.
There's one part of the book that because they needed to get from what jump like several decades to tell another part of the story, instead of like going and 20 years later. What he does is the Etienne is the nephew goes to sleep, and that chapter is called the sleeping chapter, and he has this long winding dream, and when he wakes up he's like 40 years older, and then the story picks back up. Yeah, yeah.
I slept through the 80s.
But, you know, what an amazingly, you know, creative way to progress the story like that.
I'd buy anything that has dwarves being eaten by a tiger.
Oh, no, dude, that is not a tiger. What? It is not a lion. Oh. It is a Thai lion.
Oh, what? Okay. I'd buy anything.
Is that like a liger?
Anything
a
liger? That would...
It's not like a... Well, see, that's, you know, of course, Eddie Campbell being Eddie Campbell.
It's funny until I found out they existed.
Would that be a tilian?
They're good at magic.
It's not a liger, it's a Thai lion.
Don't dick around with a liger.
Let's say you're in Chicago and you're rattling along on the L. And the one who rides beside you is a stranger to herself. Nobody knows her own heart. You might have been introduced, but you drifted apart. You're alone.
Go ahead.
That's what happens when you're gone.
Either. I sidetracked him onto his HeroClix.
Oh, that's fine. I'm perfectly content just talking about my HeroClix.
I don't have anything to talk about. No,
Wow. You go out.
I actually had a whole lot of comics to talk about, surprisingly enough. I was wondering if anybody had read Screamland. It was a miniseries from Image, and I forget the artist or writer at this time. It just finished up. It was a 5-issue miniseries, but it was pretty funny. It basically takes place in Hollywood, and this movie studio is coming out with this new movie called Monster Hunt 3000. And they have an idea to get...
What's the name of my book?
The name of my band.
They have the idea to get together these old monsters, and it sort of take the idea of if Boris Karloff and Bela Lugosi and Lon Chaney weren't actors, but they were actually, you know, Frankenstein, Dracula, and... Frankenstein's monster, Dracula, and the Wolfman. So these creatures exist, and they were actors in all of the horror movies, but they were playing themselves. And now they're sort of washed up, and, you know, the first scene, I think, is Frankenstein at, like, a comic book convention and stuff like...
Yeah, exactly.
not too different from comic book convention.
And so they're Peter pretty Baker, much out of work. Yeah. I mean, their prime was a long time ago.
Was he sitting next to the Iron Sheik?
No, I don't remember who he's sitting next to. But they want to get these three back for this movie, this new movie. And so the first... 4 issues of the 5 issues is getting them back together, and you learn what they've been doing for like the last 50 years and all that, and it's really, you know, just more funny than anything. But and then the last issue is sort of them making the movie and what happens and everything. But it was just entertaining. It was just fun. I thought it was a neat idea. The characters were, you know, just while somewhat reminiscent of, you know, the Universal monsters. I mean, they had their own personalities and as if they were just, you know, washed up actors that hadn't worked in a while and were doing anything they could to make a living. But overall, it was just fun and cool art, and it was a pretty good book.
There's a ton of stuff coming out with all the Universal monsters and that kind of stuff. No, Rick Remender, didn't he announce a project that he's working on? It's a painted book. I'd seen it on Newsarama. There was another project that's all the classic monsters.
They're just trying to remake Creature Commandos, man.
Yeah, it was, you know.
Oh, awesome book.
Didn't they read?
Yeah, they
re-released it. Yeah, they did redo Creature Commandos recently.
Yeah. That's...
He used to be in the back of G.I. Combat, didn't he, or something like that?
G.I. Combat had Creature Command. Because it was a great combination of Frankenstein, Dracula, the Wolfman versus Nazis. As if the Nazis are so evil that you can even get these dark creatures of the night to like be like...
Oh, those dudes are bad, we gotta do something.
Let's do this!
Did anybody read the Warshawski Brothers, that Frankenstein book that they did?
No.
Doc Frankenstein? I always heard that was good.
It was good. Unfortunately, it came out so sporadically, and it just killed, I think, any momentum.
Did it finish ever, or did it have a finish, or did it just...
I
Peter. I heard good things about it too.
The art was fantastic. I don't remember who.
The Frankenstein name.
It did finish?
No, it did not.
It never did finish.
The Frankenstein name kind of gets thrown around a lot, like on books.
Yeah.
So it's always kind of like, oh, Frankenstein, you know.
This
like
was, it was an interesting take.
Astronaut on Frankenstein, you know, like, you know.
Well, this was like the
monster. Dentist, you know, Frankenstein.
The history of the monster was pretty, you know, similar to the classic book and movie kind of thing. But he was much more intelligent of a creature, and he went on throughout history to be, like, you know, this soldier and warrior and kind of thing. And then this was, like, way in the future, and he's lived this entire time because he's immortal. Yeah. And then it goes, you know, just completely bonkers from there, where he's like fighting some huge religious army kind of thing. But it was a cool book. It's just an interesting take on Frankenstein, you know, a different look at it. But yeah, I don't know. Maybe they'll finish.
I still have to read the Seven Soldiers. I have the last two volumes of that to read.
Doug Mankey.
Yeah, I've heard it's gorgeous.
Yeah,
that's a cool sci-fi Frankenstein. You know, he's, like, going to Mars to fight aliens and shit.
Well, that's kind of the Wachowskis, is that he's, like...
Adventure?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Super, Indiana
super,
Jones.
Yeah, super intelligent.
Kind of, yeah, but he, like...
It's like Frankenstein, Doc Savage.
Yeah.
There you
go.
Exactly.
Doc Savage Stein.
That's what they should have called it. It would have been better.
Doc Savage Stein.
Well, Mike, I cut you off after we were talking about your gravity figure. Okay. Do you have a comic that you want to talk about?
Green Arrow, Black Canary,
yeah. Trinity.
What have I read lately? That
is Trinity
really
gonna
like?
Start picking up for you again next week? Is that
you mean picking up?
No, next. You are you back?
I honestly don't even know the issues that I've done because they're. I mean, I think it might be 12. So
how
it's
does
gonna
that
be
work?
So a couple weeks.
Yeah. So you when you get. Because it hasn't been an issue, a case of, like, every week it's been rotating art.
The way they're doing it is it's kind of a weird formula of picking an artist, because there's three of us. They're picking the artist that they think would be best for this particular story.
Yeah.
That's cool.
And then if they're, like, reoccurring, because they're reoccurring themes, if you've been, like, I've been doing the tarot stuff.
Yeah.
So they keep me doing the tarot stuff or the gangbuster stuff. Scott, they have on anytime like the bat stuff shows up,
he's
gonna
he's
be,
done the Hawkman.
He's doing the Hawkman stuff. Any kind of the bat stuff shows up, he's probably gonna be doing that. Mm-hmm. Anytime there's like cosmic or straight up superhero crap, it's gonna be like Darnik, because he's good at drawing that stuff. They've been tending to give me like the more real world stuff and tarot stuff.
I really liked your stuff with Ordway.
I like it a lot too.
It was really cool.
The cool thing about the Trinity stuff is that I'm getting to see it a lot of different ways.
Yeah.
Because I had Ordway inking tight layouts that I was doing, but by no means finished pencils. Then I had Mark Farmer do it. And it looks like a completely different artist,
yeah.
But it's awesome to see
the difference.
Yeah, and then I had another story that I did full pencils on, and Carl Kessel inked it. So I'm just getting to see like this wide variety of
guys inking your stuff.
Yeah, and now Ordway's back. So.
The cool thing with the Ordway stuff, I thought, was that Ordway has a tendency. I mean, his style of inking is very noticeable. Like it looks like Ordway.
Well, some people. He's kind of like a. A Sienkiewicz or a
yeah, but it still retained. I could tell it was still your storytelling.
I was really surprised at that myself, because I was fully expecting for it to be Jerry Ordway when I saw.
But it wasn't though. It was a really cool combo of
and,
the two.
Yeah, it was pretty amazing and cool to see. But yeah, him and like when they ink stuff, it's like him and Klaus Janson and Sienkiewicz and the guys that tend to take over artwork when they do it, and it's sometimes it works. Like Frank Miller's case, I think if you didn't have Klaus Janson, I don't think as many people would have liked.
I didn't realize
the
artwork that I was
done.
Such a big Klaus Janson fan until after I found out that wasn't Frank Miller.
Yeah.
That was Klaus.
Or even you know Joe Rubinstein on the Wolverine miniseries that he did.
Yeah.
It's a completely different artist when you look at it. It's just like I you know, growing up looking at that, going, "Oh man, I really like this." And then I saw Frank Miller, and his old pencils weren't that too far off than what he was doing
right
on, say, something like even Dark Knight 2, you know what I mean? He's always drawn like that.
Sure.
It's just he's had other inkers
to
changing stuff and fixing stuff. And
well, I like that. You were talking on the Crankcast when you had, I can't think of his name now. You had a guest on. You guys were talking about this, about your being inked by Jerry Ordway, and how you were talking about, you know, it's much closer to what the process once was.
Oh, that was probably Kalman and Dasovsky.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's the way it used to be. If you look at, like, old pencils for old comics, they gave a lot more leeway
to the inkers.
Yeah. I mean,
I was reading in the...
3 books a month.
Is this in the Tomorrow's Flash Companion where they're talking about an artist? Somebody drew something that had a lot of lines, and the inker got pissed at him because they were arguing about drawing. So the inker inked every single line, and like it looked like crap because they had an argument about, you know, and it was like that was how loose the stuff was that was given.
Yeah.
Where did, I don't know if I read that on a forum or on, because I've been reading the Tomorrow's, the Flash Companion, and they've been talking a lot about the, it's actually a lot about art, like.
Well, as much as an inker can change your artwork now. It was even more so then. It was much more of an interpretive thing, I think, back then. Even the writing to artist thing was much more interpretive. It was like, here, this is what happens in the issue. Go write the story for me, essentially.
Yeah, well, they're talking about I talked about this last week. The Flash of Two Worlds thing.
Yes.
Where it started with a cover.
Uh-huh.
And that's...
Yeah, that's where the multiverse came from.
Yeah, and it's like, make up a story to fit this cover. Because the whole techniques of coming up with stories was...
Speaking of the multiverse, what did you think of the JSA annual?
I liked it.
Yeah, I did too. I actually enjoyed...
Ordway drew that, didn't he?
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. It looked really nice. Yeah.
It looked great.
It was nice. You know, what's funny is, I saw a few people sort of review it. And it sort of displayed, I think, a weird idea of what that book was. Because people were like, oh, if you don't like the Golden Age characters, you won't like this. But I was like, what? It's not the Golden Age. It's the Infinity Inc. 80s characters from, you know, it's a much different beast. And even then,
it wasn't like...
It was about Huntress.
Yeah.
It was, which I thought was cool because I thought it wasn't overly, like... Here's all the characters from Earth 2, and we're going to jam all this in your face, and we're going to do all this stuff.
You had your couple of moments of you know...
Tons of characters,
Of characters, but it was, like you said, it was a Huntress story, mostly.
I thought it displayed the best parts of having a multiverse and the worst parts. Because you had stuff like a story where the Joker gets old.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And you won't ever have that in the main DC. Because you can't tell that story. But in the Earth 2, you can tell a story where Batman died, his foes are dying, and they're getting desperate. Yeah. And they're doing desperate things because the end of their life is coming. But then also, on the other hand, you can see the stuff like the cliffhanger at the end. I'm like, you know, you just... sort of simplified Power Girl's origin.
And then bam.
And then you got to be careful not to reopen that. But I also thought it was cool because he also gave... There's a menacing sense to it, too.
That's what I was a little surprised at.
Yeah, there's something menacing going on there.
It's a bit darker, but not to the point where it was like...
Well, there's that scene where Dr. Fate and the Spectre are talking, and you very much get the sense that Dr. Fate and the Spectre
know something
about, you know, what's going on and that they've been hiding, you know, and that Earth 2 has been hiding for a long time, and that they're the reason why it's been...
Well, like I said, they took the 80, you know, like you said, it was the Infinity Inc. and the
Justice Society Infinity.
Justice Society Infinity, and they just sort of drew all those.
But they didn't just go back to those characters and
it was a really cool Huntress story. Yeah. It really displayed how, even though they've kept the Huntress name,
how different that character is.
They lost why the original Huntress was really interesting, because it was very much based on, like, Batman got old, here's his daughter. You know, that was the place where you told those types of stories. And I always think it's funny when you hear people like, it's so confusing, you know, like, there's two Batmans. I was like, if you ever read those old stories, they never told a story where the twist at the end was, but this is Earth 2 Batman. You know, that was never the goal of the story. You always knew that this was a different, you know, there was always told to you at the beginning in the first four panels. They would always have the same picture of the different Earths overlaid. And they would explain the vibration. You know, like, the point was never to fool you about who the character is. So I always think that
they always have that up front.
It was very upfront, and it was a place where you could tell a story about the Joker getting old.
Well, I don't know if this says something about me being stupid or what. Yeah. Because as a kid, I got All-Star and Infinity Inc. Had no idea
that it was the separate Earth.
Yes,
I didn't either, man.
Had no clue. The only reason I bought Infinity Inc. because there's Infinity this cool Inc. Todd McFarlane art on it, and I was like, wow, this is really cool. I actually preferred his artwork back then to his Spawn.
They had a nice couple homages to his art in with the like weird gutter stuff.
I loved the characters in it. And I was like, wow, these are really cool characters. How come I never see these guys anywhere else but these books?
Yeah.
And so I had no idea.
But you know what's funny is.
But did you care?
I didn't care, but it was kind of confusing.
Yeah.
You know?
The funny thing with that series, though, is Infinity Inc., like 15 issues into it, they got rid of Earth, too.
Yeah.
But those characters are never set up to interact. Mm-hmm. You know, they weren't meant to be in the same universe as the Teen Titans, so once they were in the same one, it was weird to have these two people.
I like having a multiverse. I think it.
Yeah, it's fine now that I know what it is, but I mean, it really confused me when I found out there was another Green Lantern.
I
was like, what? This doesn't make sense to me. You know, kid, and I'm talking seriously as like a 13-year-old kid.
Well, speaking of multiverse, this week in Trinity, I thought that was awesome.
Well, the Crime Syndicate.
CSA.
Though I think that they have the Crime Syndicate now. And then they have the Crime Society, like the Earth 3 ones. Like, how many opposite versions of...
Wait, they have Crime Society and
Crime
Syndicate?
Yeah, that's the one that McKeever's Jokester story was about.
Oh, okay.
See, this is the thing. This is the negative.
Yeah.
This
that
is
world's
the negative.
Things get gone anyway, though.
Yeah, I mean, that's the problem. You introduce these things. I mean, that is the bad part of it, is the stuff like reopening organs.
It can get so convoluted.
You can be like...
For me personally, I mean, only because I read things... You know, much more face value and don't.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't pay enough attention to continuity.
To get bothered by it.
Yeah, you know what I mean? Like, if something's confusing, I just figure. It is. You know what I mean?
It's the same thing. It's always the thing, though, if you tell a good story.
Yeah.
A lot can be forgiven if you tell a really cool story. You know,
I think that's what gets writers in trouble, though, is they start telling multiverse stories and it becomes much more about. The fact that it's a multiverse story as opposed to the fact that make it a good story first and don't worry, you know, don't concentrate on the fact that it's Earth 2 or
Earth
6 or whatever.
It's a weird balance because you're going to have your fans that are always going to be like,
Right. They want to know. Well, yeah. Like I said, for me personally, it didn't matter. But I know people, you know, get very, you know,
you
concerned
can have,
about
The downfall of some of those old books, though, like Infinity Inc. or, Secret Society of Supervillains. Have you ever read those? Those books were obsessed with multiple Earths to the point where it became stories just like trying to figure. Most of the story was figuring out what Earth people were from.
It was a story of exposition.
It was such a clusterfuck of like all these different characters, and that's the bad. But every story, there's a balance between all things. You know, all stories.
Man,
how old do you keep
enough.
Peter
you
Parker?
Yeah.
You know, there's that balance. Same. There's a balance of...
Well, you know, it's funny. My yesterday, I was sitting downstairs, and I heard my wife was reading my son a book, and it happened to be some Spider-Man book, like a kid's book. It wasn't a comic, but it was just like a kid's children's book on Spider-Man. And then... she was asking him questions afterwards about the story, and so she asked him what was Spider-Man's secret identity. He said Peter Parker, and she had a couple other questions. Then she said, "Well, who's May Parker?" And he said, "Spider-Girl." And I'm like, "What? May Parker is
Spider-Girl."
Well, that's the weird thing about when you're a kid and you figure out, because when you were saying that, when you found out there was two Green Lanterns, that confused you. I remember when I was a kid and I found out there was two. When I figured out there was two Supermen.
That weirded me out too. I found out all around the same time.
But I was completely like, whoa! It like blew my mind. Like, these two Supermen.
I think with me, like, I didn't find, like, I wasn't reading much DC stuff until Crisis.
Yeah.
So like by the time I found out anything,
they were getting rid of it all.
So like it didn't.
That's kind of cool. But the cool thing about that when you're a kid, and this is my own personal experience, and I wish more
readers were like
fans that are my age now thought this way. When I was a kid and I saw that, I could choose to ignore it. And it's just like, oh, Superman's got gray hair, and no, that doesn't exist. No, for me, that doesn't exist. Like, I grew up, I just chose to ignore it. It never happened to me.
Yeah.
And so I'm just like, oh, okay, my life... completely normal.
But it was a cool choice. Because you also had the choice of, like, if you were interested in it, you're like, because when I was
a kid, if I did, if the next morning I feel like,
I'm curious.
I'm a little older, a little wiser. I think I want to see what this old Superman's about. I would have been fine. But until then, it didn't exist.
Didn't
just like it's every like, Highlander movie after one doesn't exist.
It's fine.
Preach on, brother.
Yeah.
Just like gravity not having telekinesis.
That's right.
It doesn't exist.
I do that with math a lot.
Doesn't exist.
Math doesn't even matter. And I work at the lumber yard.
Hey, Scott, before we wrap up this part, I wanted you to talk about what you brought down from Canada with you.
Canadian comics. It's all Tim Hortons and hockey.
Hockey man.
Tim Hortons is. You got Tim Hortons up here, which I was really surprised.
Yeah,
I didn't know that.
Yeah,
Earth 2 Wayne Gretzky.
Oh no!
He never retired.
He died on the ice.
And Steak and Shake. You were talking about Steak and Shake.
Yep. I love Steak and Shake.
Yeah, I haven't eaten there yet, but I want to.
Oh, it's good. It's just steak burger.
Actually, I got this here. I got this at a bookstore. It's the Comic Book Culture and Illustrated History, and it's got all, like, mostly Golden Age covers, and it's got backgrounds on it with all the, you know, talking about the different cover artists and all that kind of stuff. And
wouldn't it have been great if that was the book I've been searching for 3 months?
No,
I'm telling you, it exists.
That book came to you in a fever dream.
The only book that you can't find on fucking what was this one copy that someone wrote and showed you?
No, it was in Borders Books. I'm telling you,
I wrote this.
But it's the other one that I'm really, really interested in.
Yeah, the other one is. I was when I was talking online to you, I had asked you if you had read Alan Moore's miniseries called Albion.
Mm-hmm.
And
which I have not yet.
I had picked it up, and I had it sitting in my box for probably a year. I buy limited series by, like, the boxes, and I just leave them until I'm bored, and then I'll read them. So I read it, and I thought, man, this is awesome. And then about a week after I had read that, I met this old guy at a flea market, and he said, I got some comics at my place. You want to have a look at them? So I went over, and he had a stack of these old...
Did he try and have sex with you?
I'm just saying.
He'll say this...
What?
This
yes or no? Yes
what
or
happened
no?
To you, what happens to you at flea market?
I'm sorry. If a man says, you want to come back to my apartment and look at some comics?
Yeah, this could go dark real quick.
In my van.
Yeah, I would have said no.
No, I did not have sex with him, Tom. All
right, continue.
But his wife, no.
Yeah. Whoa, he did have comics.
Yeah, comics.
He wasn't lying.
Yeah. No, so he had a stack of these old Lion comics, which are like, I think from the 60s and the 70s, and they're all the British publications, and they had all the characters, original characters, that Alan Moore had written about in this series, mm-hmm. like revamping them all. And so I brought one of those down.
All right, one of the things I thought was really cool on that was all of the different countries that were listed at the bottom with the prices.
Yeah.
Can we read those? Yeah.
They were like 10 cents all the way across Australia, New Zealand, South Africa, Rhodesia.
Where's that?
Rhodesia's in Central Africa.
Oh, okay.
I don't think it's called Rhodesia anymore.
Right. Just want to make sure.
East Africa, West Africa.
East Africa.
Malta, 9D. What is that?
9D, that's like
donkeys.
That's a multi.
Wow, why are they even bothering with some of these countries?
Was this book huge in Malta?
Malaysia, 40 cents. And
Malaysians are getting screwed.
I don't even know how to pronounce that. E-I-R-E, Iera.
Those are Malaysian pennies.
Wow.
Malaysian.
So, I mean, the publication.
But no U.S. price.
No U.S. Air Canada, nothing like that.
Didn't import.
Didn't need it.
Yep.
That's
cool. That Malta business is all they needed. Yeah.
There's a lot of huge Malta. Rhodesians would read that.
Well, thanks for bringing that stuff, man. Yeah, I appreciate it.
Sure.
Appreciate it.
Yeah.
Archie the Robot's huge in Malta.
What issue is this? 7D. Every Monday, 15th August, 1970. Cool. An art.
Yeah,
featuring
yeah,
awesome. Archie the robot picking up a car.
I mean, if you
he doesn't look like a friendly robot, although his name is Archie.
There's also
wrecking people's
it
cars.
It also makes me think that he started the fire on the car next to him.
Yeah.
If I see you at a junkyard and you have a car over your head and there's one burning next to you,
maybe his name's not Archie.
Arsene. And
that's across his chest.
Well, I'm saying that could be like
some good
graffiti. And maybe that's why he's on a rampage.
Or it's like an anagram.
He's looking for the street tough that painted Archie. Oh, by the way, Tom, in Monster Leotard, they actually mentioned Street Toughs.
Street Toughs?
Yes. Good art in here, though.
Sure. Good all that UK stuff.
News, printy, newspaper. Yeah. Tell me, does Archie start that car on fire?
Royal Navy.
It would be great if it was a six-page story.
I would wager
about
that Archie is not even in the book.
You know what? I think it would be great.
It says,
six-page story.
The mighty robot Archie in action.
He's in there.
Him in action means
the first story.
First story.
It means Archie starts a car on fire and then picks up another one. Nothing else happens but him.
Who did the art on that story? That's gorgeous.
It doesn't say. Unnamed.
Yeah, like it should
An
be.
Ancient legend said that beneath the waters of the Mexican Gulf lay the lost golden city of Celica. Ted Ritchie, Ken Dale, and their amazing mechanical man, Robot Archie, set out to find it. They were in a Mexican town when agents of the mysterious enemy...
How did they get to a fucking car lot?
Diablo planted a bomb.
God, do you know whose art that looks like?
A fantastic explosion rocked the car park.
God, that looks like Somni.
Somni stole?
Does Somni steal from Archie the Robot?
I think he traces all of his books out of old issues of Lion.
In jail.
It was
in
Archie's
in a Mexican jail.
Well, I think his family did immigrate from Malta.
His family's from a long line Lion fans.
Yes.
And now he's picking up a
rural
boat.
Missouri.
He just likes picking up giant heavy things.
Well, and Archie is like the prototype for the G.I. robot, right?
I don't know. I'm just sure.
Why not?
It is now. We started that rumor.
No.
Nice.
The best part about G.I. Robot, though, is when they sit around and it's always one guy in G.I. Robot, and it's obviously this one guy having like paranoid delusions where he thinks G.I. Robot has like a mind and it's his friend. He's like, yeah, you saved me. Yeah.
Spot the clue with Zip Nolan Highway Patrol.
This is awesome.
Zip Nolan is so lonely.
Well, Scott, thank you so much.
On that Rhodesian highway. No
thank
cars.
You so much for bringing that.
Dan Dare.
And thanks for sitting in with
the
us.
The original.
Man. Appreciate
this was awesome.
Hero.
Very fun. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Cool. I'll tell you what. We need to give Mr. Mike Mayhew a call. So I'll tell you what. Let's do that right now. Joined on the line by Mr. Mike Mayhew. Mike, how you doing?
I'm doing good, Chris. How you doing?
All right. We're just recording at Dark Tower on a Friday night, saying goodbye to our Canadian friends. Goodbye, folks.
See you.
See you guys.
So, do you guys get Canadians down over in California?
We don't get them at all.
Yeah, we get just about every nationality you can imagine, so I'm sure there's some Canadians here. But a lot of Canadians are in the film business, so, you know, that kind of goes hand in hand with L.A.
Canadian. Those Canadian transplants.
Well, before we get into the comics talk, congratulations. We had mentioned it a couple weeks ago that you and your wife were expecting, and you are now a proud papa. Congratulations.
He came out. He decided to come out. So, yeah, now we got to deal with it. It's good. I mean, it's awesome just looking at that little life, you know, experiencing things for the very first time and, you know, dealing with the crying and the diapers and stuff is the other side of it. So,
do you have him like?
It's awesome.
Do you have him like flatting artwork for you yet?
I did put since I've been doing some work at home, and I did put like a little mechanical pencil in his hand, you know, and I was kind of just tripping out that he was holding it. But then he was swinging his arms around. I was like, oh, my God, he's going to poke his eye out.
Honey, oh, I have bad news.
What did you do? I gave the baby a mechanical pencil.
You what?
Yeah, I got such a charge out of that. Like, oh, my God, look, he's a prodigy. You know, he can hold the pencil.
Let's see what he does with an X-Acto knife.
Oh, no.
So
well, the other funny thing about the baby, it's got more to do with my wife, actually, because she was my model in the Jessica Jones for the Pulse covers I did. And the one piece of art that's in the nursery is her holding the baby, which is, like, you know, Jessica's and Luke's baby. And then, you know, Spider-Man and Wolverine are all around her and stuff, so... You know,
wow, your wife's hot.
Going to grow up being a Marvel zombie looking at that.
Mike just made the observation that your wife is hot.
Oh, okay. Why not?
All right.
Sweet. Hey, so, Mike, refresh my memory, because, well, when you had first emailed us, actually a while
ago. Like a year and a half ago.
A year and a half ago. But
yeah, we've been in touch here and there.
But you've been doing this for a long time, right?
Yeah, I got into comics in 93. In fact, my first book was Showcase 93. I don't know if you remember Showcase from DC.
Yes.
Where they would bust out with a lot of new guys. I think in my issue, Mike Olney was in there, maybe doing like one of his first things. So yeah, that was where I first got started and did some other things in DC. There was a book called Justice League Quarterly. I mean, this was back before everything crashed. I think they had like 10 Justice League books a month.
Yes, now. Justice League Quarterly was, yes.
That's ridiculous. So I did a little, like, I don't know, a 12, 15 pager in there for 3 or 4 months. But then I got picked up by Topps to do Zorro, and that's where I kind of settled down and got a little bit of a run on something, you know, and all that good stuff.
Wow, well, you're coming full circle then, because you're doing covers for Zorro now.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, definitely love that character, you know, and then also with the Zorro covers, just a chance to work with Matt Wagner, too. I mean, you know, he's
never heard of him. No, never heard of him.
He was a great guy to work with, and you know, he had such a different take on Zorro than Don McGregor, who I'd worked with, you know, on the other series. So, you know, it was a whole different thing for me, you know, trying to fit into Matt's vision and all that kind of stuff.
Well, for doing a cover for something like Zorro, what sort of interaction do you have with Matt Wagner?
You know, I had quite a bit. It was all email, but, you know, Matt really let me inside of his head as far as what he was wanting to do. And like, I think a big influence with him on that particular book was this Zorro novel that came out about 2 or 3 years ago. But a pretty famous author named Isabel Allende or something. I probably have the pronunciation wrong. But anyhow, the novel is great. I mean, as a Zorro fan, I was reading it and going like, oh, wow, this is so cool. I mean, it was really going into the mythos and expanding on it and kind of showing. It was like, you know, an origin story. So Matt really picked out a lot of that to play off of. And so, you know, and then also he would send me, you know, his story breakdowns and all that kind of stuff. So I kind of knew where he was going.
So,
you know, but on the other side, Matt and I are really different, you know. I mean, he's more of a cartoonist, and, you know, I definitely work more from a realistic bent, you know, pretty much all the time working from photos. So, you know, I knew what I was going to be doing was going to be different enough from what he was doing to, you know, add to the mix of everything.
So when you do a cover for the Zorro series, said you see sort of the ideas for what's going inside the book. Do you take something from inside the book? Do you take something that Wagner said to you? Or
yeah, I basically didn't have any artwork to look at. I didn't even know Francisco Francovilla.
Yeah.
I think that's his name.
Yes.
Was on the book until I was at least 2 or 3 covers in. So I was just going for those, you know, the iconic, reusable. I mean, they have their value, but sometimes they're a little overdone these days in comics. But, you know, that's the thing. I mean, books are solicited 3 months before they come out, so a lot of times you got to get a cover done before they even have any artwork done.
Sure.
You know, so actually, I think, I mean, not to play up my contribution, but I think there might have been some instances on the Zorro where they might have drawn a panel that sort of looked like the cover idea or something, you know.
Okay.
So, but yeah, I mean, like, it was cool. I would do little thumbnails, and Matt would, you know, they, you know, just point me in different directions. I think my approach on Zorro is much more spirited, and, you know, he's smiling, and he's kind of a swashbuckler, you know, that classic. But now it's really going for more of a pulp, you know, gritty, you know, darker sort of feel. So he kind of reined me in on some of that stuff and pointed me in a more shadowy type of direction.
When you're working on like a cover with that, when you're talking with someone who has like a different idea of what you're doing, which I imagine has to be different from doing like interiors on something, when you're trying to focus on one image, is it like a weird experience to spend so much time sort of debating one image?
No, I mean, I pretty much have certain ideas, but I kind of throw out a variety of options, and I kind of let the client or the editor or whoever sort of, you know, pick the direction, you know. Okay. So, like, on the Zorro covers, for, like, one cover, I would do, like, four different thumbnails, you know, and then, you know, maybe turn in a tighter version based on some notes. So it's kind of like you're both going down that road together and sort of expanding on it and changing it until everyone's happy with what they get. You know, I never turn in a cover just like, you know, I get a cover assignment, it's like, oh, okay, here you go, you know. I don't know.
Here's what you get.
Take it or leave it.
Well, you've really built up a name as a cover artist, but you do some fantastic interiors. Do you prefer one or the other, or is it kind of nice to be able to go back and forth and stretch different muscles that way?
It is nice to be able to go back and forth, because the covers, especially Marvel covers, that's the best advertisement you're going to get in this business. I mean, everyone sees those covers, you know, online or whatever, you know. So, you know, everyone doesn't see the interiors of every book, you know. So, but the thing is, I got into this business because I wanted to tell stories, you know. And it was kind of after Vampirella, where I'd done some painted covers that Marvel, you know, tapped me to do mostly covers over there. And so, you know, I'd kind of gotten a reputation, like that's kind of all I could do. Mm-hmm. So I really had to, you know, fight for interior jobs. And that's the you know, most of those are coming out here relatively, you know, in the next couple of months. So it's kind of weird that that's all coming out at once. But I've been working on most of these projects for the better part of a couple of years, you know, just in different, you know, forms of the process.
Well, let's talk about one of those projects, and it will tell you that it's been started for quite a while, because it's written by Sean McKeever, who's been at DC for quite some time, and that's your Jean Grey story. So that's actually, I think, the first time that we had gotten in contact with you. You had shown us some of the early work on that, and that's been a while. So tell us a little bit about the Jean Grey project.
I'll even tell you a story that goes even back farther than that, because Marvel contacted me to do a Jean Grey, they called it a mythos back then, and that was before X3 came out. And, it was almost like, I want to say a year before X3 came out. And I don't think you'd mind if I mention this, but actually Bendis was going to write it. And he just, you know, a lot of time had gone by, and the book really wasn't on the schedule. And the movie kind of came and went, and, you know, he ended up backing off just because he had so many other commitments. And that's when Sean came aboard, and, you know, he delivered a script that I just thought really, you know, gave me the drama that I wanted for this project. Because I had a certain concept of how I wanted to approach the art on this, and, you know, Sean's script really played into that.
Sure. Well, Mike's worked with Sean before. How do you guys...
I'd like to tell you a story about Mayhew's stuff. Sean's been showing me this artwork for, I want to say, like a year or so. You've had this stuff done for a long time.
I got the script in August of 2006.
Yeah, it's been a while. And he likes to send me artwork by people he knows will make me feel bad about myself. He does this. He does it. No, he seriously does it on purpose.
No, that's a good thing for you. That's good for you.
No, but
he doesn't like your art. It means that
he'll send me something, and he'll just say something snarky, or sometimes he'll just have a little smiley face. And that's what it. I think the last thing he sent me was some of the Jean Grey pages and a little smiley face, which pretty much means ha ha ha. You know, he was just like,
come on. I'm really thrilled to see your work with Jerry Ordway on the new That's in Final Crisis, right?
It's Trinity. Yeah, but yeah, I'm
Trinity. That's yeah. where I saw that. Right. Right.
But seriously though, that stuff was awesome because I mean, it had your. I mean, obviously, you're painted sort of. It was different because it was it. Is it different than what you've been doing? I mean, it looked like watercolors rather than.
It is watercolor because when I started, because see, I painted covers. I've never done interiors, and that's a whole different ballgame.
Right.
And I worked traditionally. I've done covers in airbrush with acrylic.
Yeah.
And it's kind of a time-consuming process because wow. you're cutting a lot of frisket and
yeah.
really building up the layers. And when I got to doing the panel-to-panel stuff, like on a 5-panel page, I was just pulling my hair out.
Right.
And I started, you know, almost, I had to try something different, and I played with the watercolor and really just grew to love that. And it, I don't know, my technique with it just really evolved over the course of those 30 pages.
Well, it turned out great, and I like it because... I think one of the signature things about like your covers are they are so hyper-realistic. I mean, people really like how, like, wow, this looks like, is this a photo or what? You know, they look at it like, I can't tell if this is actually a photograph.
Yeah,
or
your covers almost instantly go to become posters.
Yeah.
I mean, they're just eye-popping.
And immediately you start thinking, well, I wonder what this would be like if you saw, you know, like sequentials of this. And then I saw it and I was like, wow, this isn't what I expected at all. But this, I mean, the storytelling is there and everything. It's just like a it's the total package. I was really surprised, but not surprised in a like, well, I never thought he could do this. It was just like, wow, this is not what I expected at all. It was really cool.
Oh, that's awesome. I appreciate it, Mike. I mean, that's what makes me feel the best is to hear, you know, that the storytelling is good because, you know, I'm not necessarily a guy who thinks that, like, realism is the best thing in artwork. You know what
right.
I mean? I like good storytelling, whether it's, like, Ed McGuinness or you know, from cartoony to realism. I think
right.
it's all, you know, images strung together that tell a story and have emotional, you know, beats and things like that. So, you know, for that style to sort of pull that off, that makes me feel really good.
Well, that's what I kind of meant because, I mean, you see those covers and it's easy to think that, oh, wow, this is just, I'm going to open this up and it's just going to be a bunch of guys standing around looking iconic and then they'll make the dialogue fit it. But no, stuff was happening. It was actually really cool looking.
Well, that was my approach with this book is the first place I cast all the roles was Vampirella. And that was like a fully rendered pencil art, you know, so it had all the soft tones and the lighting. Mm-hmm. It was all based on these photos I was taking. And I never had the opportunity to do that, like, at Marvel. I mean, I did kind of on this book called Mary Jane, which was supposed to be colored and more in a comic book format, but it kind of just seemed to be chapter illustrations for novels.
Yeah.
But you know, so I kind of whet my appetite on that, and then, so I had this in my head that that's how I want to do, and then I think around the same time, Mark Miller started talking about 1985, and I swear, I remember this press release where he was like, they cast 100 roles, and they're doing special effects, and they're setting guys on fire, and all this type of stuff, you know, all for the sake of these photographs that they were going to use as reference. And I've seen a few of those pages, but I was like, oh, God, I mean, that's really what I wanted to pursue was, you know, you cast the role, and you let the actors perform, and you sort of get that emotional quality from them that you would from a TV show or something like that, you know?
Mm-hmm. But then they just decided to use Tommy Lee Edwards instead, so.
Yeah, but, you know, something must have gone haywire with the guys that they picked, the pages that look great, but it seemed to me that perhaps when they got to the fantastical stuff, it didn't look as good as just the normal people,
mm-hmm.
you know? So, I mean, that's definitely, you know, a challenge when you're relying so heavily on photos. It's like, well, you know, are like creatures going to look cool if they're, you know, not as realistic looking? Or, you know what I mean? That's why sometimes it's better to go with a more cartoony approach because you incorporate more practical elements without it sort of breaking, you know, fourth wall. I don't know if that's the right analogy, but you know what I'm saying?
Well, you can push,
no,
you can push
sort of
further
that
because you're not grounded to the
yeah,
realistic.
like with cartoony artwork, you know, your mind has to complete the visual. You know, but with realism, sometimes it's so complete that, you know, it's hard to read anything else into that. And when you're dealing with, you know, monsters or creatures or, you know, it's then it looks weird, you know?
Well, it's one of the great things about comic books is that you have an unlimited budget whenever you start stepping outside of, you know, whatever is drawn for your material. You have to pay for it. That's one of the things that's great about comics is that you don't have to do that. So
it's on the Jean Grey book, you know, I'm in Los Angeles, so I had a lot of access to, you know, either through Craigslist or actually for the principal roles I went to for just casted. You know, because Jean Grey, that was a trick that was tough, actually. She was supposed to be portrayed at 12 and at 16. So, you know, it was kind of tough to find two girls that look, you know, because you can't make a 12-year-old look like a 16-year-old. You know what I mean? It's like, those ages are so tough to pinpoint, you know?
Are you sure? Because I see a lot of comics that make 12-year-olds look
like 23-year-olds.
Yeah.
But that's, you know, I really wanted these girls to look like young girls. You know what I mean? Sometimes like they'll draw Kitty Pryde or something, and she looks like a 20 something, or it's like that whole Beverly Hills 90210 thing where they have these 20 something playing teenagers. You know, that's something I did with that Mary Jane novel. Is I cast 16-year-olds as 16-year-olds. I wanted them to look really authentic. You know, so that was something I wanted to carry over into Jean Grey, in that authenticity, the ages. So, you know, that was a trick in casting those roles. But I found these really two, you know, talented girls. I mean, that's the thing, too, when you're casting the roles with models or people that act, I mean, these are people that love being in front of the camera, and then they bring sort of experience in portraying emotions. You know, they know how their face is going to look and things like that. It's like, when you're shooting your buddies, that's cool sometimes, but you know what I'm saying? It's something that you wouldn't have anticipated when you're working with, you know, someone that can bring something to it, you know.
Well,
that was something I was really intrigued to explore with this book.
Tell me if I'm wrong, but were you sort of one of the first guys to bring in the sort of realistic airbrush style? Because I seem to remember when Chris had first brought up your name a year half ago, I was like, you know, I was like, is he the same guy that I remember, like, doing, you know, because I remember a point in my life back in probably in the 90s where I remember just seeing, like, these airbrush pieces that was, like, the first time I ever saw stuff that looked like it was
real.
These characters come to life. And I made that association with you, so I hope I'm right, but I maybe...
You know, I really wasn't doing a lot of stuff like that back then. I was more of a guy who got ink, you know what I mean, just a regular penciler.
Uh-huh.
I had kind of a weird evolution. Like, when I was finishing up at Zorro, they would always tell me, oh, we're not going to ink you because your pencils are so tight. I thought that was so weird, you know, like... That's just unfinished. But, you know, they kept telling me, oh, well, the computers these days, they can do all this and that. So I was kind of one of the first guys that, you know, they book ultimately didn't get published, but I think I was one of the first guys that they really, you know, took that approach seriously. So that was one weird direction. I was like, well, you know, if I'm not getting ink, then I don't have to make these lines to be adaptable for, you know, the instruments an inker is going to use. You know, I could use tone and soft edges and all that kind of stuff. And so that sort of went hand in hand with, you know, a lot of the photographs I was taking. I was taking photographs on Zorro because it was a realistic book. You know, I was having to draw horses and people in costume. And, you know, so I really wanted to, you know, ground it in that kind of reality.
Mm-hmm.
And then it all really came together for me on Vampirella, which was in 2000.
Okay.
And actually, to backtrack just a little bit, like, you know how comics were in the late 90s. I mean, I was in Manhattan, and for me, there was nothing going on in comics. I mean, Marvel was bankrupt at some point, and, you know, sales were in the toilet. And so I was really getting out of comics. I actually was doing more illustration. I got some gigs with Scholastic Publishing.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, I was really into either doing children's book illustration or, like, pin-up artwork.
Sure, sure.
Those were, like, the two realms I was straddling, you know. And so, you know, doing illustration, that's where I was painting. And, you know, I was shooting a lot of pictures for that because I wanted, you know, the paintings to look realistic and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, influenced by, you know, Norman Rockwell or all the classic illustrators.
Sure.
And so in 2001, when Vampirella came on, the kind of weird twist on that was that, you know, they hired Mike Baer to be my inker. And, I was thrilled because I think Mike's super talented, but he had to back out about 2 weeks. Uh-huh. And they told me, hey, Mike, you know, we're going to print from your pencil. And I was like, I really sat down and thought about that because, you know, I had decided to cast the role of Vampirella. I mean, I had all these photos I was working from, and, you know, I was more or less tracing these photos, you know. And so I have them on my light table, and I'm sort of, like, looking at these hatch lines, and I just, like, smudge them with my hand, and it creates these soft cones. And I was like, that really adds to the femininity of that, you know. That looks so much more, you know, lush and sensual than having, you know, these hard black areas with these hatch lines to show them, you know.
Right.
So that's really where I sort of developed that super realistic look, is on Vampirella.
Okay.
You know, all those elements sort of combined into one.
Well, the other series that you have coming out, which is, it's amazing to see your cover work and then see your painted interiors with Jean Grey, but your other new series coming out from Image is called Savage, and it is another style completely. And you had sent some black and white pages, and I had originally assumed that was going to be a black and white series, and the black and white pages look absolutely gorgeous, but it actually is going to come out in color, though, right?
Yeah, no, it is being colored. We got a great new colorist on board named Frank Bravo that's really adding to, you know, what I'm doing in the black and white. But yeah, it's like when I was working on Jean Grey, I was, you know, I'd spent a lot of time on it. I had done some other things during the course of that book, but I really was kind of, I realized, you know, that everything can't be painted. You know what I mean? Like, you want some artwork to be done quicker, or, you know, some, like, art is cooler because it's done quickly, or, you know what I mean? It's more shot from the hip type of thing.
Sure.
You know, so I really sat down and thought about it, and I, because this book has a lot of monsters and creatures, it's kind of like what we were talking about before. I wanted it to be a little more stylized, so when we got to that, it didn't, you know, it kind of blended together a little more. And so I really started playing around with the pen and ink. And also because this is I really wanted those blacks. You know, I wanted the solid blacks. I didn't want it to be, like, you know, printed for my pencil, you know, which can tend to look kind of fuzzy and soft. So, yeah, I've been playing around with the ink and the brush and the pen and, I'm just really thrilled with the results.
Yeah, the blacks in that series look. I mean, I'm pulling it up right now to show Sal. I don't know if he had actually seen them yet, but it is they're. I mean, it's really beautiful work, but it's also creepy as hell too. I mean, this is a horror series. Why don't you tell us a little bit about what Savage is going to be about?
Well, Savage basically is about a guy who could turn into Bigfoot. And he ends up fighting werewolves in the forest. So,
nice.
You know, it's just a fun romp. You know, it was created by a guy named Jeff Brant. And he came up with the whole mythology and, you know, the characters and the story. And he brought it to his friend, Steve Niles. And Jeff approached me at a comic convention and was like, hey, I'm doing this book with Steve Niles. You want to come on board? And I really, you know, was anxious to do something with Steve. And so, you know, we've been, you know, working on it for the last, you know, couple years. I mean, you know, waiting to kind of get a publisher and then getting the Jean Grey thing out. But Shadowline picked this up last year in San Diego. And so, you know, we've just been pushing forward to get the book out, you know, as soon as possible.
Sounds pretty cool.
When's it going to be coming out?
The book comes out in October, so okay. It's in the previews catalog right now. And, it's just, I'm just having a lot of fun with it. I mean, it's also sort of a, for me, I grew up reading the Warren magazine, creepy and eerie, way more than I did looking at superhero stuff as a kid. So for me, it's kind of a chance to play in that kind of playground, you know, with the, you know, that black and white artwork that, you know, with the creatures and stuff like that. It just kind of makes me feel like I'm doing one of those magazines.
Well, you see, Dark Horse is actually releasing, is it a creepy omnibus? Or is it eerie?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, the creepy archives. that they're doing.
I just think the world of that war and stuff, I mean, you know, I don't know if people really remember that. I mean, I don't know, like Jim Warren was like as much of a promotional and a talent guy as Stan Lee, you know what I mean? He really worked with the greatest artists of the time. I mean,
oh, yeah,
Neil Adams, Russ Heath, I mean, Alex Toth. Those guys did some of their best work at Warren. And
Frazetta did some...
Oh, geez, the Frazetta covers.
Yeah.
I mean, that stuff is just... I mean, it was extremely inspirational to me. You know, and just the whole package, the feel of those magazines. You know, they had a... Just like the Marvel comics, it was like you were joining a club when you bought that magazine, you know?
Right, right.
It would get the insight into the different monster movies, and they had the catalog in the back where you could buy all the cool paraphernalia and stuff. You know, I just have such fond memories of that, you know, those books. So it's kind of fun to do something that pays homage to that. And on my end, it fits with the artwork.
I was going to ask you before, you had said you were a Zorro fan, so I assume you're, well, and you're obviously a comic artist, so I assume you're a Toth fan.
Oh, enormous. Yeah. Alex Toth fan. Yeah.
How
can you not be?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, my work is a lot different from Alex's, but there's a lot of times where I wish I could just be that simple and that direct and... Have the you know, and he's a draftman. I mean, he's got skills that I can really only envy. You know, I mean, he's just, he's unreal. I don't know if you guys have checked out that Space Ghost DVD that came out not too long ago, but there's a great documentary him on there.
I heard about that. I haven't seen it yet. I keep meaning to pick that up, but I haven't.
I got it from Netflix, and I think it's on like the first or the second disc. It says in the description. But yeah, it's really in depth, and he's definitely one of a kind. You know,
I still pore over his. I picked up a couple of the Zorro archives that they've printed over the years, and man, it's just unbelievable the stuff that he's doing in there.
Yeah, he's up there with Kirby as far as influential artists.
Yeah.
I think you really have to say that with his work.
Absolutely.
Awesome. Well, Mike, it is a long overdue chit-chat with you. I know we've been bouncing back and forth emails for about a year and a half, so it's been nice to finally get to talk with you on the phone.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. And like I said, I'm always checking you guys out, so it's fun to be able to chat with everybody. And I just hope you guys keep up the good work.
Absolutely.
Thank you very much.
We're more concerned about your work than ours, so it's and yours is much more impressive, needless to say. Well, I tell you what, let's not let it be another year and a half before we talk with you again.
Absolutely, yeah. If you guys ever want to chat, give me a call, and I'll let you know if anything exciting comes on my plate.
Hey, right. Hey, before you go, when is the Jean Grey book coming out?
Okay, so Jean Grey is shipped August 13th.
Okay.
And it's 30 pages. It's like $3.99. And then, like I said, Savage comes out in October of 2008.
Cool.
All right. Awesome.
Yeah, yeah.
All right. Well, Mike, thank you so much, and we'll talk to you soon. All right.
Hey, thanks a lot. Have a good one.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.
What could make me happier than sitting right here? Trash in the walkway and the boys down in the street, they're screaming bloody murder, 'cause that's what you do when you don't stand a chance. What could make them happier than rotting right there? Bars on their windows and jelly in their hair, screaming bloody
murder. Yo, bye.
That's how I always say goodbye on the phone.
Bye.
That's why we don't call you a second time.
Bye.
So there you go, Mike Mayhew.
Did you leave those here?
Yeah.
No, that was a... Yeah.
I can't get this fucking thing back in this...
The lion?
take care of this for you.
Bag that up.
I've been trying to.
All right, well, you bag up that comic, and we're going to bag up this episode.
Oh, we're still recording?
Yeah, we're still recording. Yeah.
I thought we were done.
No, well, it's just a couple things real quick. First,
you're trying to put both in at the same time.
Oh. Please be so kind as to drop us an iTunes music review, if you would. Tom is still doing Tom versus the JLA. You can check that out a couple times a week.
Not enough people are listening. I'll stop.
Stop doing
I'll
it.
Stop. If I don't think it's worth my time.
Wow, pretty dumb. I guest on 11 o'clock comics every week, and actually Tom sat in with us last night, and we had a dandy old time.
Very funny.
I was in rough shape. I'd gone out drinking with Jason Malay and his girlfriend and my wife.
Thursday night's drinking night.
Thursday night is drinking.
New Friday.
Every night's drinking.
Hey, it's Thursday.
What?
Thursday, Thursday.
It's happening to Friday drink. Somewhere.
I'm trying to relax.
It's been a long week.
I can't face Friday.
I was so hungover from last night. I had a hard day at work.
Well, you know, I took today off from work, so went out and had some fun last night. And Jason Malay is doing doing well. I think we'll have him on the show here before too long. You can contact us at info@aroundcomics.com or email me at chris@aroundcomics.com.
I'm starting a new podcast.
Are you ready to announce?
No, well, I mean, I can tell you about
Bam.
It.
Bam!
There's nothing...
It's about your cleaning company. Yeah,
no, it's not about my cleaning company. But I will be announcing that pretty soon.
Wow, he's a man of many ideas.
And another announcement I'm going to have pretty soon, too, another project that involves around comics. Scotty and I are going to do a movie podcast called Big Awesome Movies. So look for that soon.
Bam.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, it should be in
there.
Crankcast every week still?
Listen to that.
Don't listen.
Crank is just screaming at his speakers right now.
He doesn't care. He's drunk now. So
Crankcast. Don't listen.
Check out my column at iFanboy every Thursday morning. It's called Comic Shots. You'll get a drink recommendation and a comic recommendation. Thank you, Tom.
Magazine. Something.
Dark Tower was best of Chicago comic shop.
Really?
In Chicago Magazine. Yeah.
You're going to kill that, though.
Congratulations.
All right, we got anything else? Is that it?
No. We listed all our side projects.
Yes.
Buy Tom Cater's salsa.
Hot sauces and salsas.
We'll be back next week with another full-length episode. In the meantime...
I love Tom's hot sauces.
Nothing goes better with an episode of Around Comics than Tom Cater's brand tortilla chips with a heaping bowl of Tom Cater's salsa. We have sweet,
tangy,
and
saucy,
and burn,
and drunk,
a little bit of rum.
Drunk. I would buy drunk salsa. All right, we'll be back next week. In the meantime, come on, somebody.
In between time.
All right, thank you. We'll be everywhere in
and around.
Tom's salsa.
Tom's hot sausage.
Buy two. Tom's sausage. Tom's summer sausage.
Buy one for your friend.
Have you ever been to a cabin? Have you ever desired summer sausage? Did you not have any?
Good.
From Wisconsin.
Tom.
From? Using her.
All I want to do is drink beer for breakfast. All I want to eat is them barbecue.
In the interviews or by guests of the show are solely those of the individuals expressing them and may not reflect the opinions of Around Comics. Any reproduction, rebroadcast, or retransmission without the express written consent of Around Comics is strictly prohibited. All content presented in this program is the sole property of Around Comics, and this has been an Around Comics production, copyright 2008.
I'm dreaming of a white Christmas. drink beer.